is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Natural selection is based on circular reasoning. The fittest are those who survive, and those who survive are deemed the fittest. Okay, this is one of the switch and bait things this guy's doing. That's the second point. And we have to rush up to cover the other points. Now, what he is saying here is that creationists always say this stuff about circular reasoning. And we do. Yeah, we do make a point about circular reasoning, but not with the survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest is pretty much I think most creationists would agree with. Yeah. So again, you know, going back to the buffaloes, you've got a herd of buffaloes, you've got a predator, and the predator is going to pick out the weakest. And even the old American Indians, they used to say, you know, the wolf keeps the herd strong, so that they've got strong animals they can take out and use for food. And that's pretty much one of those aspects, which is happening, which we can see in nature. And I don't think anybody says. So he is creating an argument on his second point, and this is how weak the old theory of evolution is. They have to do this stuff. I mean, why doesn't he come up with, like, oh yeah, we've got this missing link here, and we have got all these transitional species here. No, nothing. Yeah, he comes up with, which I believe is taking something out of context, switching stuff, or not fully understanding what creationists are saying, and making a point here. I think most creationists would agree with that. They wouldn't have the slightest problem with survival of the fittest, you know, within a species. But it doesn't say anything that, you know, one kind moves into another kind or survives another kind. Where circular reasoning comes in is the whole thing about the dating method. Yeah. So we've got carbon dating and other datings. Carbon dating is only precise to maybe about a couple of thousand years or something, but they come up with these millions and millions and millions of years. Yeah. And so they come up with a dinosaur bone, and they do this carbon dating, and they get a reading, and then they say, okay, it's so many years old, yeah. And so they get a reading from that. Then they get a rock, yeah, and they say, oh, and this was in this layer, you know, on this geologic column. Then they get a rock, and they say, oh, this rock is so-and-so old, and then how do you get this? Yeah, because we found it in this layer, therefore the rock is so-and-so old, and we know the dinosaur bone is in this layer because there are these rocks which are so-and-so old. And that's where the circular reason comes in, and they say, and when we take anything out of this layer, because we know this layer is so-and-so old, we do this radiocarbon dating or the other forms of dating they have, And therefore, we know it's so and so. And that's where the circular reason comes in. It all goes back to one guy in the 1800s saying, oh, we've got this geologic column. And then he draws this pretty picture with all the different columns and different bones in each layer. And then he says, oh, this one is so old, this one is so old, that one is so old, and that one is so old. Yeah. And they come up with this, with all these ages, you know, where all these people or creatures are supposed to have lived. That's what they come up with, yeah. And that's where the circular reasoning comes in. So they take something out of a layer based on some guy in the 1800s. They know or think the layer is so and so old. They take carbon, radiocarbon dating. Then they come up with, we are getting these results for this layer. So we take this bone out, yeah, and we know this bone is from this layer, and then we find a stone, and the stone is in this layer, therefore we find it so and so old. And that's, again, where it comes from. That's circular reasoning. That's the only point they're making, but not about survival of the fittest. Evolution is unscientific because it's not testable or falsifiable and makes claims about events that were not observed and can never be recreated. And that's pretty much true. Now, he comes up with lots of bloody blah about microevolution and DNA taken fossil records and DNA comparison and so on, and then they come based on that to conclusions. Yeah, but again, you can draw any conclusion from anything. The problem is it doesn't prove anything. Yeah, if you've got something which you cannot recreate, life has never been recreated, it's never been observed, the one species, there's no proof, not the slightest single proof. There are only implied ideas and assumptions. Yeah. Implications which may be there. So they see something within the genes, and they see a certain similarity of genes, and they say, oh, okay, you know, they all must have a common ancestor, because the similarity between the gene of a monkey and a man is is like that. Now, it's so close, like 95% or something. Therefore, they must have had a common ancestor. But it's all based onto a paradigm or a premise, an assumption they make, and that is that the theory of evolution is true. And then they force and try and squeeze everything into this. It gets even more bizarre. The monkey, man and mouse, I think. I once looked at this. Man and mouse, or man and rat, I'm not sure. But there's a similarity of the gene pool, which goes up to 98% or something, or 99%. It's very, very high between a man and a mouse. And between man and monkey is about 95%. There, I read some information about this some time ago, but it kind of highlights, you know, how nonsensical the whole thing is. You know, are we going to say now that man and mouse or man and rat have got the same ancestor? Some of you might agree that a lot of men are not much better than a rat. But are we coming to this conclusion that granddad was a rat or a mouse, yeah, rather than a human? And there's some really bizarre stuff going on there, but it all comes down to the premise or paradigm, and their paradigm is evolution. Now, obviously, they would say the same to me and to us, you know, our paradigm is creationism, and that there's a creator, and we stick everything in there, and we just make it very easy on ourselves by just saying, if it doesn't add up, yeah, it's a creator, it's a designer, he has designed it in this way. And to be fair enough, yeah, I take this on board and I say, yeah, okay, there's a lot of stuff I can't prove. Yeah, a lot of science which is even done by non-creationists points to a creator, and it doesn't substantiate the theory of evolution. Like, you know, the genetic research and finding more similarity between man and mouse or rat. Again, I'm not sure. I have to look up this paper again. Than between, man and a monkey. Yeah. And I think that's very, very important. It's very, very important to sort of bear this in mind. And this just ridicules the whole concept of the theory of evolution and some of the arguments they come up with. Okay, let's see what else he's got. Is evolution testable and falsified? You can't test it. That's a thing. Yeah. It's never been proven. We've never had, I mean, they come up again. Let me just put a few more arguments in here and then I move on. One of the things they've come up with is, and probably the strongest argument is the whole thing about medicine, resistivity of bacteria and resistance they build up against toxins. Oops, let me just carry on. About resistance they've come up with toxins, and I'm looking for a word and I can't find it. Anyway, let's carry on. It'll come to me in a minute. And so they say, okay, not just, you know, bacteria, but insects as well. So you've got insects. I think they used to have DDT and it worked really well, and suddenly it didn't work anymore because the malaria-carrying mosquitoes, they became resistant to it. You know, and so we've got a problem, and they would say that this is evolution. Now, the thing, what you have to bear in mind is it's not really evolution. It's just like a genetic variance, and there was a small part in the population that could survive. The part that couldn't survive the DDT was killed off, which gave free rein to multiply and, you know, become a strong population for those who had resistivity. So that was there all the time. So it wasn't really a mutation as such. Okay, let's move on. Increasingly, scientists doubt the truth of evolution. Okay. So he's making the point that this is not the case because all the scientists, you know, who are, you know, saying in their mind they don't doubt the theory of evolution. Answers in Genesis has put up a list, and there are loads and loads of scientists who, you know, professors, and they come from various disciplines as well, who are actually signing up for creationism, who publicly making a statement. It's very dangerous for them as well. You do this, you are likely to lose your livelihood because you are going against the tide. You are, and you are in danger of losing your reputation and of using chances of employment by universities because the consensus is that evolution is true by scientists. And if you dare to question it, it's a bit like, you know, the Inquisition, of being accused of being a heretic, and you end up with similar results, which means that you're deprived of your livelihood and you are expelled from the scientific community. Okay, disagreements among even evolutionary biologists show how little solid science supports the evolution. Okay, now he says that this is an argument creationists make. I don't think they're that much bothered about what evolutionists or evolutionary biologists say. He said here, if humans, that's number six, if humans descended from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? Again, I've never heard this argument within the creationist community. So he's making a big point about nothing. We, I think, understand that those guys are saying that there's a common ancestor, and the common ancestor has never been identified. Obviously, they come up with Lucy, but Lucy, when you go into this, of what they actually have, is just a joke. It's just a complete and utter joke. And whatever data they have is just a make-believe story with Lucy. And all they have is just like a little ape that's been extinct. Nothing to do with the common ancestor between human and ape. Not the slightest evidence we can see in Lucy. Okay, evolution cannot explain how life first appeared on Earth. And that's very true. Now, he makes a big argument about this, and he says, oh, we got it all wrong because we have got astrochemical stuff, and there are a lot of hints and a lot of experiments, and we can derive from these experiments that something happened, and even, you know, from stuff, you know, little stones which flew over from Mars and so on. So he comes up with all these things, yeah. But again, Richard Dawkins, he kind of concedes. Richard Dawkins is one of the prime atheists and evolutionists, and he pretty much made his life through attacking Christianity, and he comes up, you know, writing books like The God Delusion and things like that. Now, even he said, and he admitted, that they don't know where life comes from. And it's, when you think about it, it's quite complex. I once went into this, when you look at a single cell, a single celler still has got a gene code, which is about 600,000 genes. 600,000. So that's a big number. And they all need to be in the right sequence. They all need to do the right stuff. They all need to have machines, a cell machine, to try and start creating proteins and, you know, kick in. Whenever you look at a cell, you've got these things of it needs to put energy in. It needs to put the refuse, you know, from its biological processes to get rid of them. It needs to have a system to replicate itself. It needs to have a system to find food and to take food in. So all these systems, all these mechanisms, biological mechanisms, have to be there for it to function. And if any one of them doesn't function, there's no life. You know, it doesn't exist. All you have is just some some dead material. Yeah. And again, so nobody really knows. And I think Dawkins' answer was, "Oh yeah, it might have been spawned by aliens. Might have been spawned by aliens." You know, how these guys come up with that. Yeah. And again, it's not been proven. Evolution cannot explain how life first appeared on Earth. It can't. It's tried. It's failed. They did some tests in the 50s and to try and get these acids going, and they put like some sort of atmosphere in. The whole experiment was flawed from beginning to end, and the result was they didn't get anything near to what life is. Mathematically, it's inconceivable that anything as complex as a protein, that's number eight, the eighth point he's making, as a protein, let alone a living cell or a human, could spring up by chance. Again, it is. I'm not quite sure how he tries to get around with, he comes up with a computer program somebody has designed, and they had the 13-letter sequence to be or not to be, and hypothetically it would be impossible to get, but with 78,000 years to do, but then somebody wrote a computer program and he got it in 5 minutes. And that's the argument that this is the best they can come up with. Yeah. Now, if you've got some intelligence, again, the thing which gets me is, life is so complex, and this is what we understand sort of in the 21st century. It's so complex that it's not just putting a bunch of amino acids amino acids, DNA, to put it in the right sequence. There's a lot of stuff around it as well. So there's an impossibility. So when you put all these factors up and up and up and up, you come up with a hugely high number. And then that's it. And it comes up with this thing as well. And I just want you to think about this. You know, there's an analogy which is the hypothetical sequence that, you know, monkeys, you put them all on a typewriter and each one types one phrase a second on a keyboard. And this is like the to be or not to be. And then they come up, you know, take 78,000 years to try and get the sequence. Now, I doubt whether, they will ever get the sequence. There's no likeliness that they get it. If they get the sequence, what's going to happen with this anyway, if they get it by random? This guy's produced a computer program, and it's pretty much, you know, when you get the sequence, so it just counts it through. And so what they did with Colossus when they tried to crack the Enigma code, when they had a correct response, then the wheels would stop, and they would then try and interpret the message. Yeah, they would have the algorithm. They would have cracked the algorithm. That's pretty much the program they did, and it says it took less than 90 seconds. And again, it's a flawed argument. It's a deeply flawed argument. There's one thing I understand is IT. I used to work for 15 years in IT. I used to work in computer security, into hacking as well, and into cryptology, sort of how to hack things. And that's one of the things I understand. And what he's talking about, it is just a brute force hack. And yeah, you can probably do a brute force hack in a fairly short period of time. Still, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah, that doesn't mean the slightest thing. Even if by chance you would get the sequences right, yeah, by some freak occurrence, you would still have to get the thing alive. Yeah, just lining up the right assets in a petri dish doesn't do anything at all. Yeah. So the point I'm making is, he hasn't made the slightest argument. He's just he's grasping straws to do his argument. Okay, how much time have we got? We've got about 15 minutes left. The second law of thermodynamics says that systems must become more disordered over time. Living cells, therefore, could not have evolved from inanimate chemicals. A multicellular life could not have evolved from protozoa. Again, they come back with all these arguments where they say, yes, it can. No, it can't. They can't prove it. Yeah, neither can we. Yeah, that and what they have come, what they have to come up with is faith into chance. Yeah, and for us, it's faith into God, that God has decided this is what He's going to do, and so it comes. But again, it's a lot of empty stuff they are saying, and I find it shocking, just to reiterate the thing, that this is the best they can come up with to try and refute the theory of or to try to substantiate or prove the theory of evolution and refute the concept of creationism. Mutations are essential to evolution theory, but mutations can only eliminate traits. They cannot produce new features. This is pretty much what creationists say, and he's sort of trying to make his argument. So what he does is he comes up with the Drosophila fly and, you know, little legs growing on the head because they did some, you know, blasted them with radiation and all sorts of stuff. We've never gotten the super Drosophila fly. Never happened. Yeah. So mutations never have done anything to try and help them survive. Yeah. Or becoming better or more enhanced or whatever. They lose their wings, they got crippled wings and things like that. Nothing has ever been proven. Nothing has ever been proven in that area. Again, I'm getting the word now. I was talking about antibiotics before, and they're talking about, you know, the resistivity of antibiotics, of germs against antibiotics. And again, that's not necessarily a mutation. It's just a small part within the DNA. And what we can go to is the whole concept of microevolution. That's where it fits into, not macroevolution. The book, still a book, and it just becomes, or, you know, some of its mini books or whatever you want to call them, you know, they are resistant against certain antibiotica, and they become more powerful, and the antibiotica doesn't kick in anymore. Okay, we've got 12 minutes left. Let's look at the last four things, which he has. Natural selection might explain microevolution, but it cannot explain the origin of new species and higher orders of life. Okay, again, that's an argument creationists make. and what he comes up with is it's no argument at all. This is quite interesting. I would encourage you to read this article in Scientific American. We haven't got time to read the whole thing. Just reading through it would probably take about half an hour. But he hasn't got anything. He doesn't come up with any proven stuff. Yeah? All it is just like some ideas somebody had, and then we come back with a scientific theory that pretty much anything goes as long as it's peer-reviewed, and it kind of makes sense. But it kind of makes not sense as well. And if you take a different peer, a group of peers, it's not passing the peer review. Nobody's ever seen a new species evolve. That's another argument. That's number 12 in his list of, refuting. And again, we are coming to the same point as well. Yeah. So he says that's what creationists say. Nobody's ever seen a new species evolve. And then he comes up with literature, which contains reports of apparent speciation events in plants, insects, and worms. And anyway, some differences come up, and they've got new generations and new kind of species, right? Because they refuse to mate with others. And again, all we're talking about is microevolution. Yeah, we are talking changes within a species, but not crossing from one species to another. So the plant is still a plant, the worm is still a worm. And even though they might look a bit different, they've got different characteristics, but the worm is never turned into a bee or a bird or anything like that. And again, the whole argument is just down to microevolution. That's what they can prove, and that's what nobody has got a problem with. And then they use this as an argument that the macroevolution works as well, or they're a new species because one worm doesn't breed with another worm. There's one story here about Yorkshire and Lancashire butts, and they never knew why, you know, the populations are quite distinctly different and why they don't breed with one another. And again, this will be a typical example an evolutionist will pick up on and say, oh, this is how we get the speciation, that's what they call it. But still, a bud is a bud, and the bud is not turned into something else. Anyway, what they found out is that the mating call frequency for one of them is 55 kilohertz, for the other one it's a bit lower. I think it was 50 kilohertz, if I remember right. I'm not sure which way it goes round. But they would say, oh, this is evolution and so on, and that's the reason why they don't mate. But if you take a bud and you take the sperm of one bud, fertilize the egg of another bud, you know, from a Lancashire to Yorkshire, it still works, it's still within the species. You get a Yorkshire stroke Lancashire bud coming out of it. But so anyway, no argument at all. Yeah, so no argument. Evolutionists cannot point to any transitional fossils, creatures that are half reptile and half bird, for instance. And he says here that that's his answer, that he knows of many detailed examples of fossils intermediate in form between various taxonomic groups. One of the most famous fossils of all is the Archaeopteryx, which combines feathers and skeletal structures peculiar to birds with features of dinosaurs. A flock's worth of other feathered fossil species, some more avian, some less, has been found. A sequence of fossils spans the evolution of modern horses from Eohippus, an amazing fossil creature from 375 million years ago, named Tiktaalik, embodies a predicted and long-sought transition of certain fishes to life on land. Whales had four-legged ancestors that walked on land and creatures. Again, these are all assumptions this guy is making. He hasn't got a... They don't know. They don't really know. They are assumptions which are made because they find some bones and they say, oh, this is a remnant of those legs. Not realizing that this is important for the reproductive facilities. Okay, what have you got here? All we have is they found different types of creatures, or bones of different types of creatures, and it's the same thing they always do, where they say, oh, they must be in between those and those, yeah, because they look kind of similar. The same way that they say monkey and man are related, because they look kind of similar. It's no evidence. No evidence whatsoever. Yeah. And it all comes down to a paradigm. If you want to believe it, yeah, you can believe it, and that's fine. You can go along, but is it truth? Is it factual? And the question is, you can't make this statement because you just simply don't know. They don't know. It's just somebody writes a paper, oh, that looks similar to that one, therefore they must be related, and we found it in this layer, the other one we found in that layer. The dating, they haven't got a clue whether it really is correct. and it's not a precise science. There are a lot of problems with it, and it sort of goes on and on. So nothing there. Living things, that's number 14, have fantastically intricate features at the anatomical, cellular, and molecular levels. They could not function if they were less complex or sophisticated. The only prudent conclusion is that they are the products of intelligent design and evolution. Okay, this is called irreducible complexity. This is what the creationists call this. So it's, the example is used with a mousetrap. You know, take one piece away, the mousetrap has five pieces to a mousetrap. Take one away, it's lost its function. It's the same with most creatures as well. So they are highly complex. If you take anything of the complexity away, they just wouldn't work anymore. They wouldn't be able to survive. And again, it comes out with a lot of blah-de-blah. Again, I encourage you, we haven't got time yet, to go through the article to see what he is saying. Very often, he's pretty much making the point for the creationists. He doesn't really make an argument. He just says that this is all wrong because, you know, all these guys, they've come up with really good arguments, and because of the scientific methods, we need to accept these arguments. That's pretty much what he's saying here. And he's going right back to those guys from the 1800s, you know. This is all, you know, what they can come up with. This is, it's just shocking. We are at number 15 now, and it says here, recent discoveries prove that even at the microscopic level, life has a quality of complexity that could not have come about through evolution. And again, he uses this term irreducible complexity, which is sort of being, put up. And it's actually done by, a professor at a university as well. Does he make any? He just doesn't come up with anything. It's a long section he puts in this argument. So he's got like specified complexity and all the rest of it, and it's just nothing really there. There's nothing. Okay, we've got about 4 minutes left. I can't really go into this, but I want to encourage you. It's Scientific American. The article is called. Let me just go back up here. The article is called. I'm just going, so coming up right to the top, 15 Answers to Creationist Nonsense by John Rennie, and it was first published in July 2002. It was later published as well in Scientific American. It's a PDF document. Google it, and it'll come up. Actually, it's not. It's a web page. I think it's available as a PDF as well. Google it. It'll come up, and please feel free to read through it. Let me sum this up, okay? I've read this article, and I'm just shocked, you know, how little they have. And, you know, you would expect that when they try to have a go at a creationist, that these guys come up with the artillery to knock out creationism once and for all. And you don't have this. All you have is just scientific method and scientific blah, 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 and it has to be done like this, and very clever people have said this and that. And only a reasonable assumption could come to the conclusion that evolution is true, and so on. But there aren't any real hardcore facts which are presented here to try and knock out creationism. So again, sort of my friends, I just want to encourage you to you know, talk to your kids about this, especially when they have to deal in school with that. There are a lot of resources out there on the internet. There's Kent Hovind, who, you know, talks in a very simplified manner. But it's interesting when you see debates he has with high-end scientists, and he just knocks them out of the sky, literally, with words, yeah, or with arguments he presents. And he may not get everything right, but most of the stuff he says is factual and is right from what I can see. Maybe everybody makes mistakes here and there, but it's interesting as well. So when he makes a mistake, when they think he's made a mistake, they just zoom in onto this one thing, you know, and then they try and start and argue. But the problem is, you know, the truth will stand in the end. The truth will prevail.